Here on Outwork with the Ready, we use Slack to collaborate on nearly every part of making the show.
It's where we share research, talk about listener questions, and plan future episodes. That's because Slack is the AI-powered platform where work happens. It's a place for teams of all sizes to come together so they can be more productive, organized, and creative.
Plus, it adapts to our workflow, not the other way around, offering everything from messaging to audio clips. And for the times we really need to sync up on the finer points of something, Sam and I can jump right into a huddle for FaceTime. No scheduling required.
Now, if only recording our show was that easy.
Right? So whatever you're trying to grow, do it faster and easier with Slack.
Learn how at slack.com.
So you know how silos actually look when they're like on a farm?
Missiles, kind of.
Yeah, they look like missiles and they're separate. Yeah, the answer is not to build a suspension bridge between them. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Rodney Evans, and that guy in the hat and, as of 2 seconds ago, dark shades is Sam Sparland.
We're really dropping the ball on not having this be a video podcast because I was bringing a pretty strong look to the podcast today with my indoor shades.
Wait, Sam, should we commit to our next recording being our first video recording?
I think we can do that. We could put that energy out into the universe. It's going to be amazing.
Find us on YouTube, folks.
Yes.
But not today. Today, we're just going to talk. Welcome back to Outwork with the Ready. This is a podcast about modernizing organization as the future of work meets the present moment.
Each episode, we turn our attention to one common organizational pattern that we think is worth digging into. We pull it apart. We propose solutions about what to do instead.
This week's episode, we're talking about silos and structure. And amazingly, except for the Ready for Anything arc, we have never done a structure episode really on this show. I know, it's pretty wild. Maybe it's like follows our ethos of like we try to do structure last in our work and we're going to do it last in our podcast. I don't know. But it is everywhere and we do have to talk about it. So we will today. But before we do that, what kind of check-in flavor you got for us, Sam?
Oh, I've got a very stupid check-in question for us.
Fantastic, because I
for the last couple
brain cells rubbing together.
We were like, oh, we're gonna try to make our check-ins kind of relevant. You know, like it'll be like a nice on-ramp into the topic.
I remember that.
I've taken the spirit of that and just utterly kind of barely gave it any sort of respect, and then threw the rest of it out the window.
Oh,
Rodney,
perfect.
Since we're talking about silos today, if I could give you a grain silo filled with anything, what would you want your silo to be filled with?
Oh my God. This is such a great question. I don't think this is dumb. You've caught me in a very particular moment because the two things that I would love for my silo to be filled with are patience and uninterrupted sleep.
It's very abstract.
Yeah, I can't think of anything tangible. Like, I know people would be like, get money, but actually I'd rather have patience and uninterupted sleep.
And if we could stockpile those into a silo, we would give them to you.
Thank you, Sam. What would be in your silo?
I mean, I'm not going to say money because that's just lame, right?
Get money. I mean, it's not. You can say money if you need money.
How about giant ball pit?
Ooh.
Like giant ball pit.
I feel like you're going to get lost in there if it's a silo, Sam.
Probably. Here's what I want. I want to be harnessed from like up above so that I can be pulled out at any sign of danger.
How am I going to know that you want to get out?
I'll have a radio and we'll be connected via radio. And I'll
say, I feel like maybe just a regular size ball pit is better. This plan is deeply, deeply flawed.
I told you this question was very stupid, Rodney. You went with a idea of something, a concept, and I went with the most juvenile answer possible.
That's also a death trap that
also
I'm really worried
trap.
About. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that was a really weird and fun check-in. Okay, so today we are going to talk about structure. We're going to talk about silos. I am going to take a first swag at what the essential nugget is that I think makes this pattern an interesting one to dig into. And that is that an organization strategy or a function strategy or a team strategy and all of the work to bring that strategy to life is cross-functional. There is so little in a complex system that stays tidily inside of a silo. And so the fact that work is cross-functional, but the org does not operate cross-functionally is a real problemo. And that, my friend, is the pattern that we are going to get into.
It is a juicy pattern with lots of different ways to dive into it, I think. And I think in the spirit of what we are trying to do here, let's sit in the challenge for a little bit and actually give it its due. So how do you know when you are dealing with an incredibly siloed organization, let's say working with a client? Like, how do you know this pattern is true in any organization?
Well, there are usually a few symptoms that are pretty clear. One is where there are cross-functional programs, they're very, very hard to understand. And it's hard for the folks working on them to make progress. And it doesn't usually seem like it's because of incompetence or even necessarily resourcing. It is because there is not a way to easily collaborate across the org chart.
Yeah. And because it is so hard, when an organization successfully does something cross-functionally, there is a lot of back padding about, holy shit, we did this. We did this thing.
We did it.
We came together. Yeah. I mean, often, and for good reasons, these are like the case studies that are held up and like, we can work differently. We did it this time. And usually, in many cases, at least with the clients that I've worked with, it was like in a time of emergency that they had to work cross-functionally so we could just ignore all of the structure. And then at the end, we're like, oh, wow, why can't we work like this all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one way that my spidey sense starts to go up in an organization is if they have incredibly intricate workflows to get anything done. So it looks a lot like when you start interviewing people about how cross-functional work gets done, because even if they are in an incredibly siloed organization, the cross-functional work is still happening, but it's just very, very painful. And the way that that pain exhibits is often each person or each function touching a piece of work and then handing it to the next function to do their part on that
piece of work. Like messengering.
Yeah. And if we're talking about manufacturing something on an assembly line, great. That's a pretty good way of doing that type of work. And basically every client I've ever worked with, they are not doing that. They are doing marketing or HR or other kind of amorphous white collar kind of thinking work that does not lend itself well to this assembly line style of work. And that immediately makes me realize like, okay, we don't have cross-functional ways of doing things here. So we have just structures for doing this very convoluted workflow together.
Yeah. That sparks two other things for me in terms of this pattern, which is seeing the cross-functional folks responsible for a piece of work really showing up as representatives of their function. Like hearkening back to the Hollywood model episode of the Future of HR pod that we made, it's like the idea that we could have something that's mission first and we organize around what that mission is. We don't worry too much about where home base is. But a lot of times when we're operating in very siloed organizations and there is a piece of work that is cross-functional in nature, everybody shows up and they're like, I'm the marketing person. I'm here for marketing. And you're like, cool. There is a body of work here that doesn't actually care super much about what domain you're from, because we need to collectively be responsible for this piece of work getting done. And then the flip side of that coin, I think, is that I often don't think people are really clear. People who are on that cross-functional team who have been sort of called up from their silos to do the work, it's really hard for them to see what the big picture of the cross-functional project is. So I cannot think of a client I've worked in where there hasn't been sort of like one big hairy cross-functional thing that the people inside of it are like, yo, do you know what we're doing or why or like when it's going to be done or like what will be happening when it's done? Like, it's really difficult without that sort of context to orient yourself as a cross-functional contributor.
Yeah, 100%. One other thing that I'll just throw onto the table as a kind of common characteristic that I have seen in organizations that are really suffering from this pattern is there's actually very little discussion about the customer and a lot of discussion about their own internal structure. And when you think about it, I mean, this is to your original point, your strategy is cross-functional, your org is not. Your customer does not care about any one function in your organization and how well it works or who is in charge of whatever. They care about the end result of whatever it is that you are trying to do. And in incredibly siloed organizations, the customer gets lost all the
time. Totally. And I don't know how you feel, but like this is a place where I think that that is true of gigantic conglomerates and also more and more true of smaller organizations too. We're just like the service I use to clean our house. The people who clean the house are not the people who receive the emails. And there's like a third party intermediary. And I'm like, how are there three silos in this local small house cleaning business so that I can't just tell the people coming here where the key is going to be? Like, I have to interact with three different parts of this company to tell these people how to get into my house to clean. I'm just like, I should not be experiencing your structure as a customer. Yeah. And that's at the most local. And then you get to like, when you're trying to deal with like an airline and you're just like, what are the odds that any of this information is making it into a different place where it might be useful?
Very low odds.
Are they low odds? They seem to feel low.
They sure do. Maybe this one other thing to throw out there is that we're talking about functional silos because those are the most common ones.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be a functional silo. You can have divisional silos. You can have silos of other types, I suppose. So I guess anytime we're saying functional silo, you can broaden that to be more than just like, oh, here's all the marketing folks or here's all the HR folks. Even within a function, there are functions. And there are sometimes the worst siloing I've seen is actually within any one function. So basically anytime where teams are being organized and kind of kept from easy communication with each other for seemingly artificial reasons, like that's kind of what we mean by an organizational silo.
Sweet. All right. So let's talk about why this pattern is so persistent. I will just say as one data point, many of our listeners have seen our tension and practice cards out in the wild. They're also listed in the book Brave New Work. They're also available on our website. I have been in many sessions where we work in silos is the number one tension. And there's 78. So like there's a 1 in 78 chance to be number one. And that one is number one a lot. So this is not a thing that people are unaware of. This is a very common thing that is not held up as something that is making the business run well or creating value or making the customer happy. Teams consistently pick WeWork in silos as one of their number one tensions in terms of what's holding them back from doing great work.
Yeah, totally. And what that makes me think is it's obviously it's painful part, like the partly that's why people are selecting it. But to our point about why it persists, it's very, very common to have silos. So like silos are solving a problem, or we think they are solving some sort of problem. Therefore, we all have them. And also, we don't like them, which is why we select that tension card when we are presented with it.
Yeah, they feel like a necessary evil, I think.
I think so. So why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's funny. I draw some parallels actually between the silo conversation and the conversation that we had about RTO, as disparate as those things might be, which is just that I think the structure or the org chart that articulates what your silos are, it is the most visible and explicit thing that you can change in an organization. Mm-hmm. So many things in an org feel less sticky or less clear or less obvious than an org chart. And so this feeling of like, if we can just get the right organizing principles in place, finally we'll be free. It's a myth that we want to buy into because it feels so much better than admitting that there is not one perfect way that we're finally all going to sign up for and is going to solve our problems. But man, it would be nice if there was. So I think we persist in having these functional silos or, you know, silos within silos because it feels calming. It feels like a way to tame the mayhem of a large, messy, complex system that's hard to navigate.
Totally. Take the gnarliest, largest organization, and you can write down the org chart pretty straightforwardly. Like, it's not hard to do. And then once you have that in hand, you can tell yourself all sorts of things about how things work or how they should work or who is doing what. And that sense of, I think, calm or knowing what is happening or what should be happening is super attractive when the alternative is what? Chaos? Some version of some flavor of chaos, maybe?
Barf. No thanks.
Yeah.
I also think that there is something about functional organization that is positive, right? So we know that like with like in terms of jobs does some stuff. It is better generally for career development because it is easy for someone to see what the next level of expertise in their very specific kind of role looks like, which is harder to determine in a more cross-functional setting. It is easier to assign accountability. Obviously, we know that this is fraught because it's like you'll have a huge like technology implementation and the accountability gets assigned to call it like the infrastructure team, even though there's six functions involved. But it's easier to go like, you know what, you're going to be like the chest to poke. Again, it just creates shortcuts. It creates shortcuts to go, I know what good looks like. I know who to blame when things go wrong. This is a tidier way to organize work than paying attention to how the work actually gets done.
Totally. And I think there's even just a social or relationship aspect to it too. You're surrounded by folks who speak the same language, have the same expertise, who kind of care about the same things, kind of see the organization in similar ways. You can commiserate together. You can celebrate things together that other functions wouldn't necessarily understand. Like, it's nice to be around other folks who see things similarly to the way you do.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's very true. You know, I've talked before on this show about the year that I spent really reading about evolutionary biology and tribalism in humanity, and took sort of a long dive into that because I wanted to understand the social dynamics of teams and in-groups and out-groups and things like that. And like, you know, my takeaway from that is human beings are wired to assortment. Like, all we want to do is be like, how much like me are you? Now you come over here. And if someone is 1 degree less like you, they go over there. Like, that's just how we are basically wired. And so I think that siloed behavior really follows that, where I'm like, naturally, my default, my resting state is to pull people closer to me who I feel like I have more in common with. And at work, that is often going to look like the people who do the same job as me in the same way that I do it.
Totally. And I'm wondering now, if we are just trying to hijack that innate desire when we are doing things like setting up mission-based teams. I mean, is a mission-based team essentially just a better silo? Like, let's silo around a mission, a customer need, some piece of value creation that we are trying to make happen. Let's have that be our silo. And everything that we're talking about in terms of the good of silos, we get to then use in a more cross-functional way.
I think that's exactly what we're doing. We are taking the natural tendency to assort and saying, assort based on the mission. Let's have the thing that we have in common that we're going to cohere around be the most important work of the business, rather than like, Sam and I both like dumb hats and chocolate chip cookies, so now we make a podcast together. Like, let's be more intentional about what we're trying to go after. This also, Sam, goes back to the point that you made earlier. Like you said, we always find examples in organizations of under threat or in an emergency, the way that the org chart gets put to the side and people cooperate and collaborate. And I think that part of why that happens naturally is because when there's a call to do cross-functional work, when there is a program that demands real cross-functional participation, none of us want to disappoint and frustrate our home team, our home function. Like, I don't want to get pulled out of my HR team to go do a mission and have them be like, look at that butthead who is now doing work not the way that we would do it and isn't representing our perspective in that team and isn't basically loyal to us anymore. Now
probably
she's loyal.
More fun than we
she's
are having
more
right
fun
now.
With these, her new friends on this mission-based team. And I think that all of those social dynamics that do creep up and are very real kind of get put to the side in an emergency.
Right.
So it's like, to your point about hacking the sort of tribal tendency with missions, we are also hacking the emergency response to say, like, rather than it being an emergency that demands your loyalty, we're going to make it a priority that demands your loyalty. And it's going to be a really valid excuse for you saying to your home crew, like, priority that demands your loyalty. And it's going to be a really valid excuse for you saying to your home crew, like, for the next 3 months or 6 months or as long as it takes to deliver this program, it's program first, you guys second.
Well, and the maladaptive version of that, maybe there's a whole podcast episode about this that we should do, which is artificial urgency.
Totally.
Artificial urgency is a maladaptive way of creating emergency status for things. And because we 100%. Know that emergency status allows us to cut corners, cut through bureaucracy, get clear about how work should actually get done. And I think in extreme moderation, actual emergencies works great and can be easily abused.
Totally. And that sort of manufactured urgency follows the pattern that we keep talking about of the urgent over the important. We want to replace the emergency with the important work, which is often not an emergency. It's often just the right medium or longer term thing to do, like a technology implementation or like a new strategy or like a new region or like an acquisition. Like, these are important, complex programs and projects that require cross-functional contribution and are often not the urgent thing that's like, COVID started, we got to get the people home.
Yeah, totally. So we have been talking about silos, making it difficult to get work done, to create value for our customers, which at the end of the day, business-wise, like, that's what we need to be doing. But I think an interesting other thing that silos do is they reduce the rate of organizational learning. So what I mean by that is we are espousing this desire for experimentation and learning and iteration. And if we are doing those things, but in a functional way, the things that we are learning from those experiments stay siloed. They stay within their functions, which means something that the marketing team over here learned about a way of working or something about our customer that I could use over here in HR, I never get wind of. Or if I do, it's only through like gossip and like the grapevine, as opposed to a cross-functional team or just a more cross-functional way of working in general goes off, experiments, experiences those learnings, and then can more easily radiate those throughout the organization.
Yeah. So now I feel like we've gotten a little bit into the downside in terms of things like organizational learning and the customer experience. There are a couple of other things I want to talk about. And one of them is, I think one of the worst things about silo behavior from my perspective is it feels very zero sum and it almost always creates competition. Like, sort of at any altitude of an organization where there are silos reporting in, there is some version of like, who is the favored nation among the silos? Who is getting the most resources? Why do we have a hiring freeze and they don't have a hiring freeze? It's because this boss brought this person from their last company and or because he doesn't like the people. I mean, there's a million stories out there, but because we are representing our silos and the agenda of that silo rather than the horizontal cross-functional work to be done or team that we're on, it's so rare to see the kind of cooperation that's really required to do something hard.
Yeah. Well, and this is why we often talk about the politics that are endemic within organizations.
Yeah.
You've just described an environment where the primary action is political in nature. How do I gain more power? How do I maneuver my way in this community to get whatever it is that I need, which very notably, is not conversations about like, how do we do our work better, or how do we provide more value? What does our customer actually want? There's only so much attention that we have to give to anything in a given day. And if most of it is being spent navigating our own internal bureaucracy, then that's all we get. That's the zero sum nature of it.
Yeah, that's all we get. And I think even when you're operating on a small scale, you know, something I've seen happen within the Ready just in the last like 8 months, maybe even less, is folks in the source crew really being read in and concerned about the Ready, not the circle that they are stewarding. And these are very smart and very competent org designers and human beings who are like, my job is marketing. And I had a level of, I wouldn't even say it was frustration, but like a weight for a long time where I felt like I'm the only role that feels concerned about all of these things and how they work together. And it took a lot of work, for example, for like growth to be fully read in to all of the financials and transformation to be paying full attention to the pipeline. And for everybody to be like, it's not just my thing. It's not enough for me to show up with my thing and be like, any questions? I'm here to help. Yeah. I have to feel truly on the hook for what is shared by this team. And that took fucking work, man. It was really hard work. And that is with the willingest, smartest, most collaborative org designers that I've ever met. Basically.
Who are really bought into a large organizational purpose.
100%.
So think about a role in a huge bureaucracy where you could take or leave what we're actually here to do as an organization. You want me to understand what's going on in all these other functions so I can show up not siloed? Fuck you.
Exactly.
Be thinking.
These are people who give a shit about the purpose. There's not some borked up incentive for them to only take care of themselves. Like, there's nothing at play. And yet, just because of the complex nature of work, it is easy to go, I have a role. I will look through that role as a lens and I will filter out all the noise that I don't want to listen to because it's hard. And like that is so valid, but to have the kind of cross-functional team at any level and at any size that does what it's meant to, you got to get out of that.
Well, Rodney, I feel like we've made the case that silos are just pervasive so well that we should probably just end here. Like,
okay,
there's
great.
there's no way
Nailed
through it,
it
right?
Hong Kong.
Because silos are a natural part of every organization, and just deal with it. Stop being so whiny and
silos
deal with
are
your silos.
Great.
And just, oh well, that's it.
Oh well.
Oh well.
I give up.
Just kidding. We have all sorts of thoughts about things we could do differently.
Okay. Wait, before we talk about that, I'm going to make a quick commercial for what not to do.
Great. Yeah. Let's
okay,
do
great.
That. Yeah.
So, you know how silos actually look when they're like on a farm? Like
missiles, kind of.
Yeah, they look like missiles and they're separate. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the answer is not to build a suspension bridge between them.
Mm.
That is what people want to do. They either want to do a matrix or they want to build a bridge or they want to have a role that spans the silos that's going to somehow make it not – none of that is going to work, guys. None of it will work. That's not going to be one of our answers, and it's not because we didn't think of it. It's because we've seen it 1,000 times and it doesn't go well.
How does it go when you've seen it?
Mostly I find that it actually, ironically, makes things worse because there's an assumption working down through the silo that somebody is paying attention
but somebody
to what's happening
is.
In the other silo because now we've got this role or we built this bridge. So now it's taken care of and I can sort of turn my antenna off and get really back to my ball pit, you know? And not worry so much about what's happening in silo B. So I think it makes it worse because there is an assumption that it is not my job anymore for the vast majority of people. And then for the people either with some kind of spanning role or some kind of op rhythm about sharing or some kind of cross-functional steering role, they are super frustrated because they're not in the actual cross-functional work and their job becomes narrating it to other people who do not want to hear it.
Right.
So
That was
let's
compelling.
Talk about what to do. What should we do, Sam?
Yeah, let's hit a couple of different ideas here.
Okay.
So one, I think a good starting point is to start to pull apart the different types of organizational structure. I'm not going to like do a deep dive on all of this right now, but the idea that I want to put across for this first one is to start getting clear about how value is actually created in your organization.
Yeah.
And chances are it's not functionally, which is, you know,
prob's not.
Go ahead and cross that one off the list. And there are lots of different processes you can follow, workshop designs, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it's about starting at the end value created for a customer and working your way back to understand what has to happen for each next thing to happen. So when I do it with teams, I often will start at the very end and we just work our way backward until we get to like this atomic first step. And you do that for a couple of different outcomes that customers care about. You have this incredibly gnarly map. The idea of the exercise is not to make it really tight and even coherent at first. It's just to get it all down on paper. And then you can start having really good conversations about where in this value chain things get borked up. Where are we always waiting? Or where did we just put a big question mark? Because we don't actually know what happens at this stage of how something gets done. You start bringing people into this conversation about how value actually starts to get created. You can then move that conversation into, well, if we were just going to start from a blank sheet of paper, how would we organize around this work? How would we shortcut all of these steps that we are having to go through to create this bit of value? What's the fastest way we could get to this? And that is where you have the opportunity to build a small mission-based team or cross-functional team to actually go try to make that value happen in a more direct, cohesive, coherent way.
I love doing value stream mapping with teams. It's so rare to look at structure that way first. You know, and often when I do it, the only thing I would add to what you said, as we sort of track the dollar from the customer all the way through the middle, I will often ask teams to think of who the buyer and the seller is in each transaction. Hmm. So you can be like, all the way from the customer buying from the sales rep. Okay, who is the sales rep buying from? Product? Okay, who is product buying from? Engineering? Okay, who is engineering buying from? And it's like, it can be very interesting to just start to understand that all of us play both the buyer and seller role in a value chain in different moments and for different outcomes. But most of us don't think about it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is the sort of exercise where you start to see something that I was talking about before, which is that essentially that assembly line approach to incredibly cross-functional work. It'll become very apparent when you start to map how the work is actually getting done. And what would it look like for us to create fully empowered, multifunctional, cross-functional teams to actually take pieces of work from beginning to end of that value stream and having that team be our atomic unit and start to build the operating system around making those teams successful? What connections do they need to have to other types of teams? What do those engagements need to be like? What information do they need from leadership, from other parts of the organization? And now you're in this kind of iterative process of building an operating system out from a fully capable team, as opposed to from the outside in terms of a pre-existing structure drawn on a piece of paper.
I love that. Another idea is to prioritize people rotating. I don't see enough movement in organizations. I feel like a lot of times movement between functions is like for like high potential and high performance people, which I understand that you're doing it as like a reward and for professional development for the people who you feel like you want to invest in most. But I don't often think that it's discussed as much in terms of like what the organization gets when people have real empathy for the perspective of someone in a different part of the value stream. And I see this all over the place at companies as small as ours to like the biggest companies in the world. Everybody thinks that somebody else's job is easier and they're doing it wrong. Like until you're in the seat, it is just so easy to be like, no, my thing is the hard thing that takes real skill and just until you have to move. So I understand that there's a tax on that in terms of efficiency, but I think the gains are bigger than people often give credit for. in terms of how that cross-functional perspective shifts when you've worked in a different function.
And in most organizations, I don't think efficiency is really the thing we should be optimizing for anyway. Again,
well, they don't have it now, to be fair.
So yeah, let's optimize our very low efficiency to make it slightly better. No, I love that. And with rotations, there's like lots of flavors of rotations, right? Like it's not like you have to go show up in another function and learn how to do it just as well as somebody who's been doing it their entire life. Like you can just go and on the light end, like observe and understand and like ask questions, shadow for a day or a week.
Yeah.
Like that is better than nothing at all.
Yeah. I just think stuff like that, it just gives you a different perspective. And I also think that it helps you see how choices that you've made potentially impact other people. So the idea that like maybe I'm in a product team and I've done a bunch of configuration of a system that employees have to use. And now when I'm outside of that team and I have to use the system, I might be like, oh, this isn't the same as when we were testing it. The user experience in the wild is actually not amazing for the following reasons. So I love rotations. What else you got?
I think we should be thinking about different structures for different purposes. We talk about this with meetings all the time, right?
Yeah.
Type your meeting structure to your meeting purpose. Well, there's other ways of thinking about or visualizing structure in an organization as well. So for example, I'm a little bit loath to even bring up the Spotify approach because it's like
I can't imagine why.
Years ago and like everybody just wants to fight about whether or not Spotify actually does then. It. Yeah, like that's not set that aside. What I, one of the things I really liked about-
Now we're only talking about that and those, the problems.
Those videos and those articles were the idea of what they would call, you know, chapters and guilds. Yeah. Use whatever words you want. Flim flams and glim glorbs. I don't care. But the idea that your chapter is your functional colleagues who you all share a function and therefore you can get that mentorship, that development, that seeing what good looks like. You can do that without having your home base be that function. So like, what does it look like for that group, that chapter to have an operating rhythm? And what do you actually do if the purpose of that operating rhythm is to be leveling everybody up in their craft, as opposed to just, this is just our default place where we all hang out. Same thing with what Spotify would call a guild or more of a community of interest around a thing. Can you use that as a organizing principle for bringing people around cross-functional things to work on or really anything? I just like the idea that comes up in that Spotify article and engineering videos, which we'll put in the show notes, just that opens our eyes to there are other ways of organizing teams to do different things.
Yeah.
All right. Give one more.
I do. This is my wild card.
I can tell because it's just on our notes here, it's just one word.
Yeah, I didn't want you to steal my ideas.
That's some true cross-functional collaboration.
I wanted to keep it in my silo, this idea. I think one way of getting out of this that could be an interesting first move in some cases, although we almost never do it, is to just have cross-functional governance over a program. And when I say governance, I don't mean corporate governance like some of our C-suite listeners are thinking of it. I'm talking about consent-based integrative decision-making kind of governance, like sociocracy style. I feel like when I've done structure work in organizations where there's like, you know, call it like movies and studios or MBTs and platform teams or centralized and decentralized functions or whatever you want to name it, inevitably, a tension gets created at some point, which is around standards and defaults that need to be governed cross-functionally. And I think there could be a move that I have not personally tried where you actually start with that, where you take the representative cross-functional team and you go, okay, all this group is going to do is make decisions together. We're going to use this format. We're going to use consent-based decision-making. And these are going to be the decisions that steer the program. And in our steering committee, we're not going to talk about updates and we're not going to just talk about comms plans and we're not going to just look at the roadmap. All we're going to do in our steering committee is have proposals that need to be processed that are true cross-functional decisions that impact the program in some way. And we're just going to do that. I don't know. It's a spicy take because I haven't actually done it, but I was thinking about how that could be interesting.
Well, I'm on a project right now where we essentially have that group of people and we have them a little bit aimed a little bit differently. So I'm actually going to bring this. I'm going to bring this back. And
do
have
you think this would work?
I think so. Well, in your conception of it, that steering team, is that team filled with reps from the teams that they are overseeing, or are they kind of external to those teams?
I am thinking of two examples in two different companies, and one is each. Okay. So in one case, it's leaders who the cross-functional teams report into, but who are not actually doing the mission. And in another, it is a representative group from the cross-functional groups that are actually doing the work.
The example that I'm thinking of or that I'm working with is the latter. So the steering team is, it's a little bit of both. It's reps from the teams that they oversee. And then there are these advisor roles, which only show up on the steering team, including a couple of folks from like the most senior team are filling a advisor role on the steering team. So it's a little hodgepodge of both, but we should definitely have them be doing that.
That seems like a really interesting place to try the idea of like, if you think about what a steering committee is meant to do, isn't steering just deciding? Mm-hmm. Like, is there anything else besides deciding in steering? I guess you can give advice, but anyway, I think it's an interesting and provocative idea to be like, give me your cross-functional oversight crew. All we're going to do is make integrated decisions together and then monitor the efficacy of those decisions and then make more.
Yeah, for sure. And my mind immediately goes to like, all right, and then the implementation of those decisions, that can look like lots of different things, good and bad. But the retro of those can kind of come back to that steering group as well.
Fun. All right.
That's cool.
Do you have a first move?
You mean a hot take?
Hot takes. No.
We're calling them first moves now, so I feel like I need a new stinger. But also, I'm too tired to come up with a new stinger. So,
Sam, people want your stinger.
I'm just a little bee. First move time. Here we go. All right, real micro. We're going micro first move here. So I think in order to start to do interesting cross-functional things, you cannot conceptualize the work and the people as job descriptions. You have to build the muscle of role and actually thinking about the work to be done as roles. So the very first kind of next step you can take as an individual, even with no power in a team, is to look at your own job and articulate it in terms of the portfolio of roles that you hold. What is the purpose, the responsibilities or the accountabilities of the role, any decision rights that the role holds, and write those out for yourself and kind of carry those around in your head and start to use that lens for looking at other roles, other jobs that you, your friends have, your colleagues have in the teams that you're on.
Hell yeah. I dig it.
Yeah. What about you?
I want people to give themselves permission to really learn more about a different function than you think you need to, especially when you're doing cross-functional work. I think that as knowledge workers, we are very programmed for efficiency, and that often looks like tuning out what is not inside of our own function or silo or area of expertise. Yeah. But I remember working on a project many years ago, and there were really like two organizations under one roof. And one was the legacy org and one was a digital first org. And the legacy org was basically of the mindset disposition of like, we'll just keep the core business operating and squeeze as much growth out of it as we can and lob our requirements over the fence to the digital team to make a digital product out of what we do now. And it was not working well. And I think most people who have been through any kind of digital transformation are familiar with what I'm talking about right now. And it took a really long time, but the big unlock was when the digital team felt compelled to explain things to the core business in a way that was understandable and consumable. And the core business felt like it was their job to understand what the platform was and what it was meant to do for their customers and how it wasn't just automation of the core business. It was something else entirely. And I think mostly those were very smart and reasonable people who were just prioritizing their own role and their own function and thinking like, that is not my business to worry about, but we're making a real mess as a result. So give yourself permission to like go on a little mind journey into a function that is adjacent to yours or that requires your cooperation, and just like, without needing to give them your opinions, which they don't want, learn a bunch of stuff about, you know, what somebody does.
Yeah. I love it.
All right.
All right. Well, seems like a good place to wrap it up.
If y'all like what you're hearing, a review would mean so, so much to us. We love 5 stars especially, but, you know, we'll take whatever. It helps the algorithm. Or forward the show to someone who needs it. Y'all, you have been posting about specific episodes on LinkedIn and starting conversations, and people are weighing in on it. And, like, I don't know how you feel, Sam, but my heart just, like, bursts to see it.
Well, my heart gets very warm when I see that. Not in a medical way. In an emotional way.
Bro, go to a doctor.
So, we're always looking for new topics as well. So post about the episodes that we do record, but also send us ideas for new topics. We're always looking for new topics for the show. So if you have an org pattern that you're having trouble changing, shoot us a note at podcast@theready.com.
This show is edited by Taylor Marvin and produced by the one, the only, the bestest, Jack Van Amberg. At Work with the Ready is created by The Ready, where we help organizations around the world change the way they work. Thank you for listening.